Obviously,
man.
Parashat Vayikra. We start a new sefer, Rabotai. There is a custom among some communities. All right, to skip sefer Vayikra. No, on the contrary, there is a custom among some communities that when the youngsters go to yeshiva and they start to study, the first thing they teach them is the parasha of Vayikra. That is a very strange minhag, only because that is the hardest of the five books. You think start off with them teaching them stories. Instead, right away you go into the complicated, intricate issues of korbanot. So the midrash writes, Yavo'u tehorim v'yasku b'tehorim. Let the pure children come and involve themselves in the laws of purity, which is sacrifice, the laws of mikveh, etc. So I saw an interpretation of why maybe they choose this as the first curriculum to indoctrinate the children when they come for their first day in yeshiva. The subject of sacrifice. It might be a lesson for the parents that when the parent sends his kids to the yeshiva and then the child comes home on the first day and he asks the child, what did you learn about today? And the first thing the child says is sacrifice. That might be a lesson to the parents to teach them that if they want their children to have the proper growth and the proper spiritual maturity, the parents must be willing to make sacrifices. These sacrifices manifest themselves specifically in educating your children. The cost of education obviously is very, very, very steep, and a person many times has to give up a lot of other his pleasures in life in order to pay for the tuitions. It's much easier to send his kid to public school. The Torah is right away telling the parent on the first day of school, we learned the story of sacrifice. So the parent will become inspired, that he will know that if he wants his children to become Talmidei Chachamim, Tzaddikim, he must be willing to sacrifice. Now, I'm not on the tuition committee over here, but the point is, a person has to understand that that is his first priority. There was a story told of a family that lived in Ostrów, Poland. And they were father and a mother and two children, two boys. Very poor family, but like we say, rich in Torah. The father decided that it's time for the family to emigrate to America. So he took a boat, transatlantic cruise, to America in order to establish a business, to establish an apartment, etc. He left his family behind in Poland, expecting them to trail, you know, behind him. World War I broke out, and all voyages transatlantic were stopped. So the family was not reunited for 10 years. Yeah, the father was stuck in America, and the mother and the kids are stuck in Poland. So now the responsibility of educating these children fell on the mother. She had to start working. And, she worked very, very long hours in order to pay for the tuition for the children so they can go to the yeshiva. And then one day she got very good news, news that every parent wishes they would get from the teacher. The teacher said that her child, one of her sons, is a child prodigy, meaning he's a genius, and already he has surpassed all the curriculum of the Heder, and he has to go further, and he has to get private tutors, and you have to keep him excited. So the cost of these tutors obviously was very expensive, and she doesn't have the money. But she said, don't worry, hire more the tutors, I'll pay for it, she'll take care of it. And this lady used to, after she put her children to sleep every night, she would leave the house and she would go deliver milk to all the different homes on the outskirts of the city. And she did this for many years until she was able to come back to America. Which means a lady is willing, not only she kept a day job, but as she kept a night job. But not only a night job, what kind of night job? Imagine somebody's wife over here going delivering milk in order to pay for what? For supplement education. It's not paying for the primary education. Well, that child eventually grew up to be one of the Gedolim in Israel, Rav Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg. Oui. Tzaddik Shalita, which is Rabbi Scheinberg, Rabbi with the Sisiot, the big, he's not so big. He's big because he wears all the Sisiot. He's one of the Gedolim. But where does this come from? Think it just comes from Stab? No, because his mother was willing to sacrifice Ad Kedei Kach to go deliver milk to the different homes. Why? So we can have a good teacher. That's the sacrifice that we're talking about. Behind every great child, there has to be great parents that are not so far behind. And therefore, the Torah is telling you, start the children off with Parashat Vayikra, teach them about sacrifice. So the parents will be reminded of the importance. Today, unfortunately, parents are not even willing to sacrifice. Now I'm not talking about the liver milk. They're not even willing to sacrifice a vacation to be home with their children. I've said many times, you know, a child tells their parent that they're expecting. And then the parent says, no, very nice, the first child, when do you do it? We'll do Pesach. Pesach, what kind of planning is that? What kind of thing is that? You're killing the whole holiday over here.
All right,
we're going to miss you 100%. If it's a Milah, we'll come home for the Milah, and then we'll go right back. We'll do you a favor, we'll come home for the Milah. And hopefully you'll hold it until after the holiday. What are we talking over here? Which means today we've become so parents by proxy. It means we don't want to sacrifice anything. We want to do what we want to do. And children, unfortunately, today have become an interference. They become a hindrance. Like, you know, they're bothersome. It's cumbersome. Here the Torah is telling you, look at what a parent has to do. A parent must be there for his children and must sacrifice. I heard a chiddush once from Rav Meir Shapiro. I didn't hear it from directly. I never saw Rav Meir Shapiro. But I read it in a sefer. The Gemara says, be careful of the people, the children that come from poor homes. They took to the rabbis. Rabbis, watch these children very closely. Why? Because from them comes the greatest Talmidei Chachamim. So, you always understand this Gemara. Why? Because the children are usually humble. They're not going after the pleasures of this world. No, well, the other rich kids have money, they're going, you can't tie them down. And the poor kids, you know, they have nothing else to do but study Torah. They don't have computers, they don't have Game Boys, they don't have television, they don't have money to go to the restaurants. They're sitting all day long in the yeshiva, with a sefer in front of them. So it's not even b'nei aniyim. They're telling the teachers, be careful, he's b'nei aniyim, shemim tesu Torah. But Rav Meir Shapiro said differently. He said, you know why? B'nei aniyim, from them will come Torah. Not because of their sacrifice, but because their parents had to sacrifice for these children. Which means, if you have a ben ani that's in the yeshiva, how is the parent paying their tuition? How is the parent, making such a situation? Why? Normally, ben ani, they need their children to work for them. You know, they can have their child help them supplement their income. Instead, when a father who's ani sends his child to the yeshiva, he's making the greatest sacrifice, that he's finding a way that his child could learn. That sacrifice will make the child a better child. Which means nobody should think that the things that you do for your children are just, they have no impact. There are some parents that I know till today, they fast every Monday and Thursday for their children. Imagine that, every Monday and Thursday, not Rosh Hashanah, not Kippur, not Shabbat. 365, 52 weeks a year, Monday, Thursday, they betanit. What are you fasting for? That my children should grow up to be Talmidei Chachamim. That my children should grow up to become Tzaddikim. In our generation, you fast every day. That's how dangerous it is. But parents are not willing to sacrifice anything. They don't want to change their schedule. They don't want to pay for tuition. They don't want to hire tutors. They don't want their lifestyle to be effective. They just want to, you know, have children for the status of having children. Chas v'shalom, those children at a great, great disadvantage. And maybe that's why the Torah is telling you, start off with Vayikra. Start the children off so the parents will be reminded of sacrifice. There's a Pasuk Avraham Avinu says, when Avraham Avinu was about to sacrifice his son. So Avraham Avinu was involved in a tremendous amount of Mesirut Nefesh. the ultimate sacrifice. Sacrifice his own son. We know how much Avraham Avinu wanted a son and how much he loved Yitzhak. At that point, it says, "Vayikra elav malach Hashem min haShamayim." An angel from the Shamayim came and stopped Avraham. Said, oh, "Avraham, Avraham, al tishlach ayadecha lanar, v'al tasmo le'uma. Don't do anything." So I saw from one of the rabbis. Actually, I heard it from Rabbi Moshe Simantov, alav shalom. We had it once at yeshiva dinner, and he made the following remark. He said, "Why does it say Vayikra elav malach Hashem min haShamayim?" The Malach called him from the Shamayim. Wait a minute, where's the Malach going to call him from? The Malach, of course, calls him from the Shamayim. The Malach is in the Shamayim. Isn't the word Shamayim superfluous? So he came along and said an amazing Hiddush. I think he quoted from somebody. He said, the Malach, when he came to tell Avraham Avinu to stop, he could not penetrate the zone where Avraham was standing. It was too holy even for a Malach to stand there. And therefore the Malach had to call Avraham min haShamayim, which means he had to call him long distance. Which means the Torah is going out of its way to say, at the time of the Akedah Yitzhak, the area of Avraham became so holy that even angels could not stand in that area. So therefore, Yikra Avraham min haShamayim, which means God told Avraham, this is too kadosh for you, only Avraham can stand there. So the rabbi asked, what made that area so kadosh? Because that was a father that was involved in sacrifice. Now this was the ultimate sacrifice, but he says you have to know any time a parent sacrifices from himself for the sake of his children, you have to know at that moment it's a tremendous amount of kedusha. When a parent's deciding on on a certain vacation, and the parent says, you know what? It's not the best for the children. Even though the parent says, wait a minute, I deserve a vacation. I'm working very hard. I want to go away. And they make a decision that, no. So what is that? It's a tremendous amount of misurut. At that point, it's explosions. Tremendous amount of kedusha. Or yeah, you have a parent. A parent might want to have a TV in the house. The parent says, no, I'll keep it in my bedroom. I just want to, watch myself. I don't want to, I deserve enjoyment a little over there. But what? The children. When the parent goes out, what do you think? The children go into the parent's bedroom, and they turn on the TV, and they're watching. And therefore, you're not willing to sacrifice yourself for the children. And therefore, the children are at a loss. So therefore, the Torah is telling you over here, parents, if you want to have good children, you have to be willing to give up from your own pleasures and your own enjoyment. Furthermore, the Pasuk says, Vayikra Elav. God calls Moshe. Vayikra Elav. Hakamim say Moshe Rabbeinu was very humble, obviously. Torah says that. And Moshe Rabbeinu was very ethical. He had derech eretz. Why? He didn't enter the Mishkan until he was called. Vayikra Elav. Now, even though Moshe Rabbeinu, we would call him in Hebrew, Ben Bayit. Moshe Rabbeinu was Chas v'Shalom, he's a friend of the Shekhinah, so to speak, which means if anybody has rights to walk in and out without an invitation, it's Moshe Rabbeinu. I'll give you an example. Imagine I'm coming into the shul, the Shachrit. This is my shul. Imagine I stand at the door and I knock before I walk in. Rabbi, what are you knocking? I can come in? Yeah, Fadal, come in. What are you knocking? Rabbi, if anybody doesn't have to knock, it's you. Moshe Rabbeinu, it's his Mishkan. He's the one that speaks to God. He's the one that was up there for 40 days and 40 nights, by the way. So if there's anybody that doesn't have to knock into the Mishkan, can just walk in, it's Moshe Rabbeinu. And by the way, nobody would think otherwise. Nobody would say, oh, chutzpah. No, he just walks in without an invitation. Yeah, Moshe Rabbeinu. He can do whatever he wants. But the greatest of Moshe Rabbeinu was what? He gets to the Mishkan, he stands outside. All of a sudden he hears, Moshe, Vayikra Elav, and he walks in. To show you the derech eretz of Moshe Rabbeinu, the humility of Moshe Rabbeinu, the ethical standard that Moshe Rabbeinu had. That being said, the flip side, the Gemara writes, Kol Tamid Chacham, Shem Bo Da'at, Nevela Tova Hemenu. It says about this Pasuk. Any Tamid Chacham, I explain Tamid Hakam, any religious Jew. That's why I explain Tamid Hakam, not the rabbi. any religious Jew, because today, in the eyes of the world, any religious Jew is considered a rabbi. If you walk in the street on King's Highway, the Yarmulke, into a goy, you're a rabbi. A lady walks outside with a wig, she's a rebbitzin. Finished. So then when the Gemara says, Kot tamid chacham, means a religious Jew. She'en bo da'at, that does not have intellect, nevera tova himenu. A dead carcass is better than him. Wow. What are the rabbis talking about over here? Usually the rabbis are very careful in their language. Yeah, they don't just talk nevera over here. They don't talk street talk. Here, all of a sudden, they come along and say, a dead carcass. Whoa, that's a very, very powerful analogy. And what does it mean, she'en bo da'at? And why is a dead carcass better than him? So I like to explain this the way I saw from Rabbi Huchna. What does the word da'at mean? Da'at, you explain to me, intellect. That's a loose interpretation. Da'at we see used twice in the Torah context. One time you see the pasuk, Adam yada et ishto. And Adam knew his wife. That's a way of saying he became close to his wife. And the Torah says it in a nice way, that the intimacy of the Torah is through yada. So yada means to come close. Yada also means to separate, to come apart. How do you know that? The Gemara says in the fourth parakha of the Amidah, Atachon El Adam Da'at, on Motzei Shabbat we add a special paragraph called Atachon Atanu. What does that Atachon Atanu say? God, you gave us wisdom that we have the ability to separate between Kodesh and Chol. And that's what we put it in that parakha, because without Da'at, you do not have the ability to discern between right from wrong, day from night, Kodesh to Chol. So you see, sometimes Da'at is the wisdom to come close, and sometimes Da'at, the Rebbe says, is the wisdom to separate. That's somebody who has Da'at. He knows when to come close. He knows what to say. This is a poor item. He embraces it. That's Da'at. This item over here, not good. He separates. Da'at sometimes is the wisdom to know when to get close to something, and Da'at is also the wisdom to know sometimes to separate from something. That's the two contexts of the word Da'at. Moshe Rabbeinu had da'at. Why? Because he knew in this case over here, you don't come close. What do you mean don't come close? Why don't you just walk into the Mishkan? No. Moshe Rabbeinu knew in this case over here, you have to remain apart. You have to remain separate. Why? Not derech eretz. But you're Moshe Rabbeinu. You're right. But that's a bad precedence. To teach people just to barge into a room or barge into a house without being invited, without being told to, especially the house of God, even though you're Moshe Rabbeinu, that would be improper. Hence, Moshe Rabbeinu had da'at. But what about a Tamid Hakam, a religious person that doesn't have this da'at? He doesn't have this sensitivity, which means he might have a lot of Torah wisdom, but he doesn't have this ethical behavior and this moral standard. The Gemara says a carcass of an animal is better than him. Why? What's the halakha? A person wants to write a Sefer Torah. You can only write a Sefer Torah on parchment. Parchment from a kosher animal. Let's say the animal was not slaughtered properly. And they club the animal over the head. The animal is called a nevela. You cannot eat it. Could you use the parchment for a Sefer Torah? But? So the halakha says you can. Which means so long as the animal is of a kosher species, even though it wasn't slaughtered properly, the cloth can be used. So what's the explanation? The explanation is the following. You take this cloth now, it's a nevela. It's not kasher. It was from an animal that is not proper. And all of a sudden, you start to write the words of the Torah on it. What happens to that carcass? It now becomes elevated. Usually when you put Torah, even on something that's mundane, even on something that's not holy, the Torah has the ability to transform it, to sublime it, to elevate it. A Tamid Hakam, a religious person, when he studies Torah, Torah is really supposed to change him. Torah is supposed to make an impact on him. Torah is supposed to elevate him. Torah is supposed to change his character. Torah is supposed to make him more sensitive and more compassionate. Kol Tamid Hakam she'en bo da'at. But if a Tamid Hakam that studies and learns, and he doesn't change, he doesn't become more refined because of it, he doesn't become more proper because of it, nevela tova himenu. A parchment of a dead carcass is better than him, because it becomes elevated by the words of the Torah. But the Tamid Hakam that studies and doesn't change, he's worse, because he has remained the same. He has not allowed the Torah to do its effect by making him a better person. But there might be another interpretation why a carcass is burned. That's what he says. It's a very important interpretation. But there might be another interpretation as well. We are very influenced from Talmidei HaChamim. As a matter of fact, we're told by the Gemara, you have to let yourself get influenced by Talmidei HaChamim. You have to serve them, learn from their ways, study their ways, because everything they do is, there's a source, there's a reason. They call that Shimush Talmidei HaChamim. Talmidei HaChamim is a Shimush, Yotem in the Muda. The internship of watching Talmidei HaChamim is even greater than learning from them. Oh, so what's going to happen? You have a Talmidei HaChamim that's not refined, that doesn't have the proper midot, doesn't have the proper ethical behavior, and all the students are what? The Talmidei HaChamim. If he does it, must be, it's okay, must be, it's right. They're fooled because he has an air of Torah, because he does study a little. However, they don't realize that they are being influenced by negative trait, by negative behavior. Even though he might be a big scholar and he has a lot of Torah, but if his method or his derech or his attitudes are not proper, that's going to affect the students. A dead carcass is better than that guy. You know why? Because at least a dead carcass emits a smell, a putrid smell. So people know, keep away, stay away. You're warned. But this Talmidei HaChamim, he's a wolf in sheep's clothes. It's Hadush, Divrei Torah. So, oh, wow, the guy. How many times you have a rabbi that might be a little crooked? Oh, he's a genius. He's a genius. Every rabbi that went off the path is a genius. Go on. You're right. That's why people get fooled. They get fooled by all the Torah and all that. But what? He teaches them negativity. He teaches them sin'ah. He teaches them all sorts of bad behavior traits, etc. And therefore, a nevilah is better. At least a nevilah is a sign. Keep away. Keep out. But Talmidei HaChamim she'en bo da'at, he is fooling the people and he's causing the students to get drawn in as well. Hence, nevilah Torah emenu. The Torah goes on. Torah says in Pasuk, this pasuk bet. Pasuk bet. What does it say?
You do something wrong and they'll hold it again. Oh, you remember Rabbi Manson, right? And this is the way. You know?
Right. You're doing a bad. You're supposed to be an ambassador, right. Not a. So the question is: it says a fellow will bring a korban to Hashem. So it doesn't call the fellow an ish, it calls him an Adam. When an Adam comes, and he brings a Qurban. So the Gemara wants to know, what does Adam have to do with this over here? Why is it referring to human being over here as an Adam? So the Gemara makes different didashot, but basically the Gemara is saying that you have to bring the Qurban when a person sins, just like Adam and Ishon, when he sinned, he brought a Qurban. So too, when a person sins, he has to fuck. Just like Adam, he made a sin and he brought a Qurban. So too is telling you, Adam, you have to be like Adam and Ishon. You make a sin, atone with the Qurban. So I once heard that, what was Adam, the only one that brought a Qurban after he made a sin? Noah also brought a Qurban. I mean, you have other people in history that did bring Qurban. Why is Adam the prototype of a Qurban of a sinner? So I saw an explanation like this. Adam is the prototype because a fellow might say to himself, when do you have to bring your Qurban Hatat? We're learning about now in the Gemara. A guy did, let's say, B'Shabbat by mistake. He turned on the light. By mistake. He forgot it was Shabbat. Or he didn't know you can't turn on the light. Shogeg. He turned on the light. He has to be a Qurban Hatat in that case. If the guy did it on purpose, then he doesn't be a Qurban. And then they kill the guy.
He's a Qurban.
He's a living Qurban. He's a human Qurban. Exactly. They throw him off a building. They stone him to death. Now you might say to yourself, well, what ta'il? What are you getting so... You know what it means to go bring a Qurban? I mean, you have to take off a day off of work. You have to go first to the meat market, to the cattle salesman. You have to buy your korban. Now you got to walk in Yerushalayim with a sheep in your hand, whatever it is, a goat. You got to go stand on line. What do you mean? There's a line. I mean, you have to go to the bank. They have tellers. They have guanim over there. They have the thing. Gate number four. But there's only one mizbeach. So therefore, it's a long line over there. The guy standing in the Beit HaMikdash over there with all the other sinners. And all of a sudden his time comes, and you got to slaughter it, and yeah, you got to go. Now, let's say the guy doesn't live in Jerusalem, by the way. Ooh. Let's say the guy lives in Tel Aviv. Let's say the guy lives in Chutz La'aretz. He's got to make a trip. So the guy now takes him a week. And what do he do? Why? Because by mistake, he forgot it was Shabbat, and he turned on the light. Wow. A guy might say to himself, come on, what's the big deal? Now, I don't know if you realize that a korban costs about $500. How much do you think a sheep cost? It's a couple hundred bucks. That's a steep penalty. You know, even if a guy is speeding, they give you a $190 ticket. Here, the guy didn't do anything. He wasn't even negligent. $500 they make him pay, and that's besides the ticket to get to Jerusalem, and he's got to stay overnight in the hotel. All that's part of the kapara. And he's got to change. He's got to get a new shirt when the blood falls all over it. So now the guy's thinking to himself, "What did I do?" So the Torah reminds you, Adam, just remember the consequence of Adam's sin. If you want to know the impact and consequence of sin, always go back to Adam HaRishon. Adam HaRishon, when he ate from the tree, you have to understand there's a lot of interpretations that explain how Adam thought he was justified. So much so, the angels did not understand why God was punishing Adam for eating from the tree. Because it was so much logical that it even fooled the angels. That being said, it was a sin. We are still getting punished for that one mistake that he made. People are still dying, unfortunately, as a result of sin. Ladies are still having difficulty in childbirth as a result of that sin. Right. And everybody has to go sweat to make a living. B'ze'at apecha tochal lachem. So therefore, you say, wait, how many years? 5,700 years later, and there's still fallout. It's like a nuclear bomb. You know, 20 years later, there's still kids being born with four eyes, you know, because of the fallout of the nuclear reactor. So the sin is so... And what? Adam HaRishon made teshuvah for 130 years. For the next 130 years, he didn't eat, he rolled himself in the thorns, it says, he suffered, and still what? God said, Sarahta, I forgive you. But what? The consequence is still there. I forgive you, but bottom line, the sin the damage is done. So now when a person comes along and he says, my gosh, this is Adam HaRishon that did one sin, and it was done with kavanot, with the thumbs and all that, and still it has an impact that it affected the entire world for 5,700 years. So now when a person goes to the Beit HaMikdash for turning on a light by mistake on Shabbat, it's not a small thing. It's a big thing. So the reference to Adam HaRishon is to remind a person, when a person makes a sin, there is great aftermath. There is great destruction. There is great consequence. A person shouldn't just think, okay, big deal. Like some of the prevalent attitudes of today is, well, you think God really cares if I turn on a light? The modern guys. Who says that? The Ma'al Shabbat say that. No, not the Shomer Shabbat. The guys Ma'al Shabbat. So, what is God? God just cares if you're a nice guy. Do you pay your taxes on time? Are you good to your wife? Are you a good father? Do you spend time with your parents? Are you a good son? You think God really cares if you come out of the bathroom and you say, "Shady, what are you being, sort of, and the answer is, yeah, God cares. You think God cares if I never eat from the apple? It's all good. He cares. Yes, he does care. And he cares a lot. And therefore, your korban is definitely warranted. You're not doing something that's superfluous. You're not doing something that's, above and beyond the letter of the law. Adam HaRishon reminds us of the severe consequence of our actions. The Torah then tells us about the law of... Is it Perek? Oh, that cannot be. Let's see, maybe it is. Yeah, Torah tells us the law of... Ti ole veyored. That's Perek He Pasuk Yud Aleph. That's right. That is the variable korban. Olev yoreh means the korban that goes up and the korban that goes down. What is this referring to? Certain sins, you have to bring a korban. The korban, preferably, if a person has the funds to pay for it, is an animal. If he cannot afford the animal, he buys a turtle dove. If he cannot afford a turtle dove, he pays for a meal offering. Now, that's a very strange thing, because we're giving you options based on your bracket. I mean, the guy comes to the Beit HaMikdash with his tax return. You know, they look at it and say, oh, you made this much money this year, so you made this sin, you got to bring an animal. Another guy comes along and says, I'm a middle class guy. Oh, middle class guy, you have to bring a turtle dove. Another guy comes along, Hazini, he gets, he's on welfare. They come along, shut up, oh, welfare? Okay, you have to bring a korban. You're not going to get a dove. But they give him, you pay it in flour. You don't pay him flour. The government will pay for the flour, but you got to bring the flour to the Beit HaMikdash. So Rav Pam over here makes a very, very important point. What's the deen, the Gemara says? If a rich man comes to the Beit HaMikdash with a flower offering, is it yotze or not yotze? The Gemara says, not yotze. Why? Because a rich man must fulfill his obligation relative according to his wealth. And if a rich man wants to get off the hook and pay his debt according to the status of a poor man, he has shirked his responsibility. Rav Pam says, similarly today, if a rich man is being solicited for the tzedakah, today we don't have korbanot, but we have still payments to the tzedakot. If a rich man pays his money to charity based on the income tax return of a middle class man or a poor man, he has not fulfilled his obligation in tzedakah. Many times today, a rich man will give charity with the attitude, I'm giving more than my neighbor. I'm giving more than the next guy. But that's not the proper gauge on a person's charity. He has to be given relative to himself, not to somebody else. For example, if I were to say about two people, both these people, Ashrehem, they learn 4 hours a day. To one it might be a compliment, to one it might be a negative. If one guy's a businessman, he says, oh, he does 4 hours a day. Wow, for a businessman, she'd be genuine. But if another guy's a rabbi, and I come along and learns 4 hours a day, that's all he learns 4 hours a day. She'd be learning 12 hours a day, which is 4 hours a day. That's a disparaging comment. The same thing. A guy might come along and say, wow, these two guys here, they both gave $1 million to Sadaqah. To one guy, it might be a compliment. Maybe the guy's worth $10-15 million. He gave $1 million to Sadaqah, so he's in the Maaser range. Another guy might be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So to come along and say this guy gave $1 million, so what's $1 million? $1 million might sound like a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money relative to what he's worth. That would be analogous to the guy coming to the Beit HaMikdash with a meal offering. Hey, you're not a meal offering guy. Your value, you're supposed to be bringing a $10 million offering over here. You can't get off the hook by bringing a cheap offering. So the first lesson Rav Pam says is, the rich man must give charity according to his level. I never did a study on this, but one can analyze with all the money that's in our community, Kenyan Boo. If all the people in the community would be giving ma'aser, would be giving 10%, which is, let's say, the minimum amount that they should be giving to tzedakah, I wonder if there really would be deficit in the yeshivot, whether it's here in Israel. Which means, even if a guy gave $1 million a year in charity, but if he has a lot of money, which means, I don't know how this works over here, but it's possible if you have even one Jewish billionaire, that means he has to give $100 million to tzedakah. Now, $100 million in tzedakah, that'll probably... Well, yeah, I understand that. Let me give it once. I understand that. I understand what it means. Over the course of however many years that it took to amass that, $100 million of tzedakah had to be given. So, I mean, if everybody was giving what they're supposed to be giving, I wonder really if there would be deficits in the yeshivas and all that. So even though we might be impressed by large numbers, but it has to be if that's what the guy is supposed to give. Now the question is the opposite. The Sefer HaYuch is the opposite. Let's say a poor man comes to the Beit HaMikdash, and the poor man comes with an animal. Do they accept it or not? Sammy's right. They don't accept it. Now you might argue, what do you mean, he's a hero, this guy? Which means, what do you mean? He came along, he went, he bought an animal, he spent his money and all that. The Sefer HaYuch exactly is saying that. You have no right to go spend and overextend yourself more than you can afford. The Torah doesn't want you to strain yourself. On the contrary, you can afford a meal offering, real a meal offering. You have no right to go now and spend extra money to bring a korban. You have to know you're not a rich man. And the poor man has to know his class. Is he better or worse? Not better or worse. For that person, this is what God wants him to be at this given moment. And therefore, the Torah is coming to tell you, Adrabah, he brings a korban according to his means. From here, Rav Palm learns a very important lesson, that everybody has to spend according to their means. But before you do that, you have to recognize where you stand in the world. Are you a rich man? Are you a middleman? Are you a poor man? And then each one accordingly has to spend according to what he has. Unfortunately, with all the prosperity that we're enjoying today, so everybody has gone after certain luxuries of life, whether they can afford it or not. How many times do you hear people that really can't afford certain vacations, but because you know, everybody else is doing it, and therefore they want to also join, and therefore they put themselves in haq, and they put themselves in debt, and until they cause themselves to have to collect. What are you collecting for? We're collecting because you went on a vacation, or you bought a house, or you did things that were beyond you. But everybody's doing it. No. Everybody has to recognize where they stand. And of course, a person can afford it. Okay, good luck to him. And it should be pointed out, the Torah is not punishing the rich man over here for being rich. Which means you might come along and say, no, maybe for Shalom and all that, maybe let the rich man also bring a meal offering. The rich man didn't do anything wrong. God blessed him with rich. Bring a korban according to your status. And the poor man, bring according to your status. Which means there is an attitude over there that the rich man is always wrong. The rich man, he's guilty for being rich. Who is he to be wealthy over here? How dare you have more money than the next guy? It's not right. And therefore there's like a certain class envy against that guy. What do you want from the guy? So long as the guy's fulfilling his responsibility. No, others will say, it's not fair to have rich people because they put a pressure on the poor guy. In Klai Yisrael, from time immemorial, there was always classes of people. You see, from the Quran, whatever you did. What does the Torah say? Let the rich guy now, like communism, divide all your money equally with everybody else. So this Shalom Yisrael doesn't work that way. So for a poor man or a middle class man to come along and blame the rich guy for his overspending, that's not proper as well. But you, to come along and say, I had to buy because my neighbor, you have to know who you are, you're not your neighbor. You have to know, and you cannot blame your overextending lifestyle because somebody else did it. He was able to do it, you were not able to do it. That's not going to be a valid excuse. Just like the rich guy cannot get away with spending less on his tzedakot by saying, well, I gave more to the next guy. It's never judged something. Everybody has to know their status. Today, unfortunately, because of this card over here that we call a credit card or a debit card, so today people are able to access credit that they don't have, and therefore that causes people to put themselves in what?
You have a black card or a black card?
No, black card. This is not even a credit card. Black card. This is a banking card. This is the only that you take out what you have in it. They don't have credit. In any event, black card. I have a purple card there. That's the thing. Olay v'yoreh teaches you that everybody has to know exactly what they have, and the rich man can't spend less, and the poor man cannot spend more. Furthermore, the Torah tells us in Perashah כיכול שאור וכל דבש לא תקטירו ממנו אישה להשם. What's that? That would be, I have it here in Pasuk Yod Aleph. Let's see, where is it? Aleph? No, why I have it like that. Perek Bet.
Exactly.
Going back a little. כל המנחה שתקריבו לאדוני לא תעשה חמץ יכול סול ויכול דבש לא תקטירו ממנו אישה לאדוני. So the Torah tells us that there are different ingredients that are considered contraband, that are forbidden to go on the Mizbeah. Again, the Mizbeah, you put meat of the sacrifices, you also poured wine, and you also sometimes poured water. On Sukkot, you also put flour and oil and the frankincense and the limonah. But the Torah is telling us that there are two items that have no place on the Mizbeach. Yichol Seor, Yichol Devash, Lo Takiru Mimenu, Yishel Hashem. And the Torah really doesn't give us a reason. It's one of those items that are just a hawk. You know, you can't do it because you can't do it. But I once saw one of the Mefashim give a musar of maybe what the rationale of the pasuk is. Seor and devash are polar opposites. Seor is like sourdough. It's yeast, very, very sharp, sour, bitter tasting item. A devash is very, very sweet. The Torah is telling you whether it's the extreme sweet, that's devash, or the extreme bitter, that's seor, lo taktiru men el Hashem. That's a reminder to the lesson of Harambam that says a person has to be in his temperament balanced. The Torah is telling you any extreme behavior is not accepted. Now, extreme behavior doesn't mean extreme in religion and observance, of course. Harambam was not saying that one should be mediocre in his observance. Person has to be very extreme in his observance, of course, to keep the 613 mitzvot. That goes without saying. Harambam definitely was an observer of the 613 mitzvot. He wrote a book explaining all the 613. He didn't keep 200 out of the 613. The Rambam's golden means, or the Shvila Zahav, or the Derech HaMemutza, whatever you want to say it, means in character traits, in personality. When a person has a balanced personality, so then already he's on the proper way. Sometimes you have an extreme personality, it's not good. Because an extreme personality, you say, oh, it's good, why not? He's using it for the good things. You're right, so long as he's using it for the good things. And then when he starts to use it for the bad things, wow. And he becomes an extreme drug addict, and he becomes an extreme alcoholic, and he becomes an extreme compulsive gambler, so therefore, that extreme behavior didn't serve him well. So a person always has to be not too generous, not too miserly, somewhere in the middle. He has to be balanced. He has to have certain equilibrium. Ki chol seor v'chol devash lo taktiru v'menu d'Hashem. All too sweet and all too that cannot be accepted. Now, midot, exactly. Midot, you have to have the measure. That's why midot are called midot. Midot is a measure. Midah is a measure. Like salt. A person puts salt in his soup. So you have to measure it first, how much salt you're going to put. If a person puts too much salt, it burns the soup. A person puts too little, there's no taste. So therefore you have to measure exactly the proper amount and the soup tastes good. Not too much, not too little. You have to be somewhere in between. You have to be somewhere in the healthy balance in that scale. Now that being said, the Torah goes on to tell us the laws of Gezerah. What's the laws of Gezerah? The Torah tells us in the Pasuk would be at the end of the Beracha actually. Right towards the end. Veshivet gezelah asher gazav. Right? If a person steals, so he has to return the item that he stole. So they once asked one of the Gedolim, if a person stole money, and now he wants to return it. But he doesn't know where the guy is anymore. Mm-hmm. And maybe the guy's not around. And, he can't find the descendants of such a person. So if he can find the descendants, he should make reparations by paying the descendants. There was once a 90-year-old guy. He went to one of the Gedolim and he told them, you know, he stole money many years ago and now he wants to pay back, and he can't find the guy, can't find the descendants. So okay, he says, yeah, you have to make an effort to find them. So he tried to make an effort, he couldn't find them. All of a sudden, a week later, he comes to the rabbi and says, I took care of it. What happened? The guy broke his leg. 90-year-old man, how's he? Broke his leg, they took him to the clinic. When he gets to the clinic, he's standing online, and sure enough, who's online with him at the clinic? One of the heirs to this guy that he stole from. So beautiful, it's Min HaShamayim, Borei Olam gave me a broken leg, in order that what? I should be able to find this guy. He paid him 1,500 rubles or shekelim, whatever it was, and he got off. So the rabbi told him a lesson of it. He told him, you see that? When you make an effort to pay back, Borei Olam will arrange it that what? That the guy will surface, or a relative of him will surface, in order that you can pay back. But that's only because he wanted to pay back. But what happened? There was one guy, he couldn't find, he made an effort, nothing surfaced, nobody was around. It was a different country even. So what happened? The rabbi told him, in that case, take the money that was owed to you and dedicate it to public works. What is public works?
The streets.
To the streets, to the bathhouse of the town, to the cisterns, to the water supply, do things that, to the mikveh, shippuz, or something like that. Why? Now raise public works. One day, somebody of that family will come and ride down that street, or come and benefit from that mikveh, or benefit from that, and already it'll be considered if you're paying them back. So, Rav Chaim Kanievsky once told a story that if everyone went to the grave of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai in Eretz Yisrael, that bench is there. That bench where you could sit and you know pray the whole day long outside. Also, a bench where people could sit. So this was donated by a certain fellow that was his nedava. One of donate benches by the kever of Eshbi. So what happened was, there was once a guy sitting on one of these benches, and he was very tired, you know, traveling in Israel and touring the whole day. And he got to the bed, finally was able to sit for a little while in front of the kever. So he was very, very thankful. He said, you know something? He said, the guy that did this over here says, tremendous hana'ah he gave me. So they asked the guy, they investigated, who's the guy that donated the benches? And after they found out, this is many years before, that guy had stolen money from this guy. He says, that guy, I don't know that guy owes me money. And where is the guy? No one knows where the guy is anymore. They didn't meet each other. And here, what did he say? He says, look, he benefited me today. So Rav Chaim said, you see that? When you donate money to public works, God will make it that what? That the guy who you owe to, he'll somehow take a benefit from that. You go, you build a park. One day, the kid's going to take his children and swing them on those swings over there.
Nice.
And the money will somehow get back. But you have to make an effort. You can't just say, how's he going to get it? That's not your business. No, you have to try. There was one time a guy, show you how careful you have to be in Gezerah. It's a big test. Obviously, if you're in business, it's a big nisayon. There was one type of guy. He's from Miami. He sells watches. He went to a certain company in New York City. So he goes to the company, and he's buying watches from it. He's buying from the wholesaler. The guy has all the papers on his desk of all his suppliers. Now, of course, you don't look at those papers. You can't look at those papers. Those are for the wholesaler. He's selling you. You can't. The guy had walked out of the office for a second. And I got a big yitzhak. You can just, get all the sources. What do I got to use this guy for? And he sees the main paper. He's writing the order. He sees the number right over there. So he says, you know what? He's got to do it. He can't control himself. So the name of the company was the Geneva Watch Company. Okay. So he doesn't want to write it in English, because maybe the guy will see him writing it, so he's going to write it in Hebrew. So he writes, Gimal Nun Bet He. He looks at it, Geneva. He says, Geneva. He says, what am I doing? You thief, what are you doing?
Great one.
The paper, he says, look at this. Borei Olam, I'm stealing information over here.
Ah, good one.
Guy in Miami told me this story.
He knew it was a company.
He looks at his skin. Wait, what am I doing over here? Is it worth it for a couple of dollars to come back as a gezud? So Pasuk says, Ve'eshiv et ha-gezelah asher gazal. Sometimes you return it directly, and sometimes you return it through the descendants, and other times you return it, like I said, by donating it to the public works, and still that will be considered a tikkun for the sin. But not to pay back at all, that already is, the Torah says that's unacceptable. A person has an opportunity to fix and right the wrong that he did, that he has to do such a tikkun. Hey Rabbi,
so he talks about him. I have a shit.
Bye, Rabbi. I see more. Which one?
The rescinded. Writing or not?
Yeah, he rescinded.
In writing?
Yeah, and the guy rescinded also.
I called Rabbi Elbaz.
Who rescinded?
Rabbi. Both of them.
Rabbi rescinded and they fished him out of the Uzza?
Yeah.
Can I tell him, Rabbi? So now we have to go one step further.
We do. Well, we're going to reaffirm. Don't worry. At a meeting of Mount Sinai with all the rabbis.
Yeah?
Sure.
But what if the other guys say, listen, we're not obligated to come because you called us. Who are you to call us?
No, no, we're going to have the big rabbis that are going to be behind us.
That's your rabbis because you guys, you know.
Wait, wait, wait.